You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California Governor Jerry Brown holds the record for being the state's youngest governor and also its oldest governor. As he nears the end of his record fourth term in office, many are turning to talk about the L word, legacy. A new profile in the California Sunday magazine seeks to provide some new insights into the governor and his thinking as he prepares to depart the governor's mansion. Joining us now is journalist Andy Kroll, who wrote that piece for the California Sunday magazine. You can find a link to that article on our website at kvpr.org. Andy, welcome to our program.
It's great to be here, Joe.
You write that Governor Brown essentially learned to be a politician starting in 1998 when he was elected mayor of Oakland. That's quite a remarkable statement for someone who had already served two terms as governor and led several unsuccessful campaigns for national office before that. Why was that experience so significant in forming Jerry Brown 2.0?
Well, you have to think about how Jerry Brown burst onto the political scene in his 30s. In the 1970s, he skyrocketed basically from the Los Angeles Community College Board to the Secretary of State's office to the governor in an incredibly short amount of time. And really, you know, he did not do what a lot of politicians do, which is you climb your way up, you learn at each rung of the ladder until you reach the top, usually at the end of your career, not at the beginning of your career. Well, what Jerry Brown found when he left the governorship in the early 80s, took about a decade and a half off of elected office, and then returned at that local level, as you say, in 1998 as mayor of Oakland, he got that firsthand ground level nitty-gritty education in what a mayor does, what a politician does, what a government does. Every day it was right in front of him. It was outside the door to his Oakland loft. It was just outside the walls of his small office. He got a political education that he did not get when he was flying at 35,000 feet as governor in those first 8 years.
How do you think that's managed to manifest itself then in these last two terms in office?
It's made him more pragmatic, without a doubt. It has caused him to, I think, take a more, if not skeptical, certainly a rigorous eye toward programs and regulators and other kinds of governmental, you know, layers, really, that come out of Sacramento that he maybe was fine with the first time around as governor. But since being mayor and seeing how that played out with local development, seeing how that played out with schools, I think he has got a better appreciation for local control, especially for education and also development, and also saying, you know, do we need this organization in Sacramento overseeing development, or can we get rid of this and let the municipalities in the counties handle this instead?
And certainly local control has been a big hallmark of his administration, the most recent ones in Sacramento thus far. He also, though, has big priorities, big projects that he wants to accomplish statewide. Of course, we think here about the bullet train and also the famed twin tunnels, which may be whittled down to one tunnel. We'll see where that goes. But you paint the picture of Jerry Brown, the pessimist, one who is always looking about the danger or the dark side that could be lurking right around the corner, yet he's still one who wants to build these coalitions and do these big projects, increasingly things like maybe his father did generations ago. Do you get a sense that he recognizes the potential conflict there in trying to sell a big picture plan and also trying to emphasize the negative in a situation?
I think he does. I mean, I think he personally is this wonderful bundle of contradictions when you talk to him about whether it's the Delta tunnels or it's the bullet train. But then if you move just, you know, off that topic of conversation onto the topic of, you know, his broader philosophy about the role of government or how he sees the trajectory of human society on the with the levels of consumption we have, these things seem to be at odds with each other. And yet he finds a way to sort of pull them together under one umbrella, under one sort of school of thought, which, you know, really is just Jerry Brown in his, you know, sort of singular way. I was struck as I followed him around, whether I was in Sacramento with him, whether I was in Frankfurt, Germany with him, that he would not sugarcoat things. That he, you know, he is in a lot of ways the antithesis of another great Californian, Ronald Reagan, who would talk about Morning in America, who would try to convey a positive tone, a warm feeling about the direction of the government, the work he was doing. Jerry Brown will say, as he did, you know, some people like to say how great things are. I like to say how bad they are. In order to make the, you know, in the spirit of making change, he said at a press conference earlier this year that the next governor is going to be on the cliff. What is out there is darkness, uncertainty, decline, and recession. Good luck, baby. And no other politician would say that to his successor. And so he is this sort of bundle of contradictions, but it's worked for him. And especially in these last few years, he has used this persona, I think, to great effect.
You mentioned the contrast there between Jerry Brown, the pessimist, and the sunny optimism of a Ronald Reagan who preceded him in office. What about the comparison between Jerry Brown, the younger, and Edmund G. Brown, the elder, his father, who also had two terms in Sacramento? You write that the comparison, when people talk about Jerry Brown's first years, they often do so in Freudian terms. How has that relationship with his late father now maybe become more complex?
It's one of the great father-son stories, you know, in the genre of fathers and sons that is already stuffed with, you know, incredible tales. You know, in his first two terms as governor, young Jerry Brown seemed to be going out of his way to draw a contrast between him and his father, Pat Brown. Pat Brown was a builder. Pat Brown built thousands of miles of new freeways in California. He ushered in the master plan for higher education, the aqueduct, the state water plan. Jerry Brown, in his first two terms, would talk about, quote, creative inaction or an era of limits. He seemed to be rebelling against his father in so many ways. And yet, in these last years of his governorship, as he told me the last time I spoke with him one-on-one, he's come to a greater appreciation of the big projects, the types of long-lasting work that his father did. And he sees value in that. He sees that those kinds of projects, if they succeed, outlive ideas, they outlive philosophies, and that I think that when we talk about Jerry Brown's incredible push for high-speed rail and the Delta tunnels, as we saw in his State of the State and in subsequent comments, I think that's a reflection of this recognition of the value of these big projects like his father did, and a sort of a late in life appreciation of what his father accomplished in Pat Brown's 8 years as governor.
Is there a consistency you see in terms of ideology between Jerry Brown 1.0 and Jerry Brown 2.0? Certainly, he's always had critics to his right. He also most recently has had critics to his left, among many of those in the progressive wing of his party who have criticized his involvement with the oil and gas industry. Is he more conservative now, or is maybe that creative inaction that he talked about in his first two terms in Sacramento, or is that just another way to look at laissez-faire approaches to governance?
That's a really good question. The way I see it is that Jerry Brown has always tried to defy any kind of label put on him. In Jerry Brown 1.0 from 75 to 83 did not want to be labeled an old school politician, did not want to be thought of as a sort of a machine governor, maybe like his father was. And so he tried to strike this balance down the middle. I'm not part of the old guard, but he also said, you know, I'm not some woo-woo, new agey, Zen mumbo-jumbo philosopher either. He tried to strike that middle ground to mixed effects, without a doubt. I think Jerry Brown 2.0, there is a parallel in that again. He is trying to find his own path, chart his own path. I wouldn't say he is a conservative or that he is in the pocket of big oil, as some of his critics on the left have argued. But also, Jerry Brown has very consciously tried to keep a distance from the quote-unquote resistance under the Trump presidency. You know, he says resistance brings to mind, you know, the underground in World War II and people risking their lives and people dying in defense of their cause. Obviously, the resistance today is incredibly important, and people are putting themselves out there on the line. But he doesn't see himself as part of that either. He is, again, trying to find this lane that is just his alone. And so I think that the context of the two governorships is obviously different. But what Jerry Brown 1.0 and 2.0 have tried to do is very similar in trying to find a way through them.
You write that he bristles at the talk of legacy, but is he in any way self-reflective looking back at his accomplishments both in this go-around and earlier, or is it always just looking forward?
He is a self-reflective guy, without a doubt, and I wouldn't be surprised if one of his post-governorship projects was a book of some kind, or maybe a speaking series where he tackled a certain number of issues that he has already addressed in his time in public office. He does not want to dwell, though. He does not want to wax philosophical about what he's accomplished or how he got this deal done. I mean, I asked him on a number of occasions about how did you muscle through the SB1 infrastructure bill with the gas tax? How did you find the coalition of people, Democrats and Republicans in the legislature, to get the cap and trade extension approved by 2/3. And he doesn't want to relive that stuff. He doesn't want to take you back into the time machine, let alone take you back to his first two terms and talk about, you know, what, you know, the worst thing you can do, I found, is to ask him, you know, what was going through your mind when you did X, Y, or Z. He does not want to do that. In that case, he's looking forward. He's looking at his next move, his next bill, his next speech. He does not want to dwell, as I say in the piece, on something that's already done. In that way, he does have his eyes set forward all the time.
And in writing about those negotiations, both with the gas tax and the cap and trade extension that was recently passed, you write, to get a deal, Brown took steps that a more ideological politician would not have stomached. What does that tell us about Jerry Brown, and maybe more so about California politics? Is the deal-making process an increasingly rare one, especially what we've seen in recent history in Sacramento outside of the Brown administration, and maybe with what might be to come?
I do think that's the case, especially if you look at the polarized political times that we live in right now. I mean, Washington is obviously the ultimate example of the absence of any kind of effort at deal making, and really, you know, members of the Republican Party, members of the Democratic Party isolated in tribes. California is increasingly a one-party state, and you have Democrats in a lot of ways acting on their own to pass legislation that is important to them and is part of their progressive agenda. And the Republican members of the Assembly and the Senate can often be bystanders to that. What Jerry Brown tried to do and succeeded in large part at doing was finding ways to bring Republicans into the fold. I think he prided himself on his ability to pass these bills and to show that California was not a solid blue state where Republicans are cut out, and that these bills that he was passing are just the product of Democratic legislating, that Republicans were part of this. I mean, you know, in the rest of the country, Republicans have almost nothing to do with climate-related legislation if they believe that climate change is man-made and real at all. But in California, Governor Brown, working with then-Minority Leader Chad Mays in the Assembly, got 7 Republican Assembly votes for a bill to extend cap and trade. I mean, that sent a message, I think, not just to other states and to Washington, but to other countries around the world. And he really doubled down on his deal-making and bringing those different members together in this past year. And I think we'll see it again this year, too.
I know Governor Brown isn't fond of talking about his legacy, but others will do so nonetheless. If high-speed rail and the Delta tunnels, if those don't go as planned, certainly those are both long-term projects, and we will be many years before we see what ultimately happens. If those don't go as the governor suggests, and they get stalled or they get piecemealed out or somewhat half finished, so to speak, a portion of high speed rail built in the Central Valley that doesn't fully connect to either LA or San Francisco, if that happens, what does that mean for the governor's legacy in your estimation and the people you've talked to?
Well, on its face, any of those two projects, high-speed rail and the Delta tunnels, falling short and certainly not coming to fruition will be a major defeat for Governor Brown. He has, in his speeches, in his comments to the press, staked out a huge part of his last term in office, his last years in office, on getting those programs on solid footing and on a path to becoming a reality. And there's just no way around the fact that if the high-speed rail does not come to fruition or even survives in some shortened, smaller form, if the Delta tunnels happen in the form of maybe just one tunnel or not at all, that'll be a defeat for him. And I think that's why you're seeing him so aggressively push for both of these projects just in the first few months of this year. And you'll continue to see it in the upcoming months, you know, right until I think he leaves office in 2019, pushing for those projects. Now, if you try to ask him about, you know, do you want these projects to succeed because of your legacy, he will go off on you. He will attack the notion of legacy as lazy journalistic shorthand and a modern invention that is just a placeholder for doing the tough thinking that he prides himself on. You know, legacy is something he doesn't believe exists, at least for governors. So he does not see these projects as part of, you know, a legacy, if a legacy even exists. But I do think that the success or failure of them, or as far as he can get them down that path during this last year, will shape how we remember him, without a doubt.
Andy, just a few days ago, the state suffered the loss of one of the governor's top aides, Nancy McFadden, who passed away after a fight with cancer. How big of a role did she play in the Brown administration? How significant were her contributions to Governor Brown's recent terms?
It'd be hard to understate Nancy McFadden's role in the Brown administration's successes, not just of the past year, but really of the last almost 8 years since Governor Brown returned to office right around 2011. Nancy McFadden was the day-to-day lieutenant in Governor Brown's office. I heard this time and again from colleagues of hers and the governor's, especially interest groups and activist groups and members of the legislature, especially. Nancy McFadden was the one doing the day-to-day negotiating, arm-twisting, charming, cajoling on all of the governor's big legislative priorities. If we talk about the SB1 infrastructure bill, if we talk about the cap and trade extension, Nancy McFadden was right in the center of all of those legislative battles, if you could call them that. And she would get the negotiations far enough along where then she could bring in Governor Brown, her closer, who would use his wisdom and his experience and his, I guess you could call it charm, in a sense, to get the deal over the finish line. But those deals would have never gotten done, I think it's fair to say, if Nancy McFadden hadn't been in there in the governor's office making it happen.
So with her loss, what does that mean for the governor's agenda the rest of this year?
I think it's a blow to the governor's agenda. I think it's going to make progress on these final big ticket issues, whether it's the Delta tunnels or the high-speed rail, more difficult. That doesn't mean Governor Brown's eagerness to get those projects done will wane. If anything, I can see him saying he wants to get them done to honor Nancy McFadden's memory. But again, it is hard to understate how valuable and important she was to the functioning of that office on a day-to-day basis and in a big picture sense as well. And so it's a tremendous loss for the governor, and it will have consequences, I think, on his ability to finish out his year in the way that he wants to.
Before we go, Governor Brown is someone who ran unsuccessfully for U.S. Senate. He's someone who several times ran unsuccessfully to be president of the United States. He wanted that national and international stage. In a way, though, now, is he actually fulfilling those dreams through his new heightened international role with climate change and this being the leader of the largest state in the union?
I think he is, in a particular way. I think he is, as I write in the piece, an alt president of sorts, that at a time when more than half of the country is dissatisfied if not upset with the leadership coming out of Washington, there's a vacuum for a governor to step into that vacuum and to lay out a vision for the country and how, you know, we should act in the world that does not, that, you know, that is a rebuke of the current president. And so I think that as Governor Brown has traveled around the world, he's traveled to China, he's traveled to Germany, he's traveled to the EU Parliament, to Norway, talking about climate change and really talking about how the U.S. will not back down on its pledge to, you know, fight the causes of climate change. I really do think he has itched that scratch, or scratched that itch, if you will, of international leadership that maybe he sought when he was running for president those three times, or when he ran for Senate once as well.
You can find the link to the new piece about California Governor Jerry Brown in the California Sunday magazine. You can find the link on our website, kvpr.org. We've been talking with journalist Andy Kroll, who recently wrote that major profile on the governor as he prepares to leave office in his record fourth term in Sacramento. Andy, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.